This seem incredible, but I have heard something similar from people in the Ukraine. People with no reason whatsoever to lie. In 1998, at the height of the famine Kim the father and Kim the son had created, they did what they do best, blamed somebody else. One September day in Unification Square, a crowd of thousands saw a score of officials shot, including the Minister for Agriculture, So Kwan Hee. They went one better and dug up his predecessor, long dead, and shot the corpse of Kim Man Kum, too. In the zombie state, you can't be too careful about the dead. The response from the West to this slow-motion tragedy was dire. For a long time, the famine was denied or downplayed by some Westerners who spouted North Korea's official line. Kim Jong-il threatened nuclear proliferation, then offered nuclear talks, then went back to threats. In this atmosphere, the famine victims became pawns in a chess game about the nuclear threat. Andrew Nachos was then running World Vision, one of the biggest NGOs in the world. He wrote a piece in the Washington Post criticizing the Clinton administration for its overly political response to the famine, putting Western geostrategy over humanitarian considerations. But the great problem for people like Nachos was that the regime denied famine, and powerful evidence of the death of millions was lacking. So therefore, the fashionable logic went, it was not happening. In his book, The Great North Korean Famine, Nachos quotes an NGO worker on the nightmare of working out what was what inside North Korea. I can identify with a recent visitor to North Korea when he said he couldn't sleep, not due to jet lag, but because of the difficulty in sorting through the ever-present and strong ideological message. A Norwegian UNICEF official told us that he had served in Uganda after Obote took over, worked in Afghanistan, and worked in Zaire, but this is the most difficult location, not because of physical safety, but because of a sense of not knowing what is going on. Nachos's uncle had died in Greece due to the famine caused by the Nazi occupation of his homeland. This family tragedy must have been at the back of his mind, as Nachos ignored the official denials of famine. Nachos went to Pyongyang, was stonewalled by the regime's officials, and saw a comfortable, if eerily strange, capital city with no one starving. Not believing the non-evidence of his own eyes, he went up to the Chinese border and interviewed defectors. They told him the truth, that North Korea was gripped by a great famine. One eyewitness was 27, whose harrowing description of a train journey to the Chinese border reminded Nachos of trains packed with Jews on the way to the Holocaust. Train carriages with 120 seats carried 700 people, squeezed into every space imaginable, many of them the starving Kochibis or wandering swallows, the Korean term for internally displaced people. At the height of the famine, fear of the regime weakened and much of North Korea degenerated into a state of anarchy. The rules forbidding movement inside the country were swept aside as the hungry became more and more desperate. The Kochibis would climb on the roof of a train, hang off the sides, hold on underneath, and crowd into the toilets. As a result, people urinated where they stood. The stench was sickening. The train would stop due to power cuts. Nachos's eyewitness continued. Dead bodies were taken off at train stations. Some riding on the rooftop would die accidentally when they stood up and touched the electrical lines above the train. Altogether, I saw 20 dead bodies during my trip. Some people riding between the train carriages were trapped and squeezed to death because of a sudden train stop. Some hanging over the train car entrance fell to their death. But this evidence of famine was dialed down by some, including a few NGO workers, who said that because it came from defectors, it was suspect. The greater problem was that Kim Jong-il continued to play the nuclear chess game, leaving the West sacrificing pawn after pawn for no gain. The dismal drift of Western policy changed when Pyongyang itself admitted that, yes, there was a famine and they needed help. In the spring of 1997, North Korean diplomats at the United Nations met with Nachos and other big NGO officials and asked for food aid. The Americans replied yes, but said that they needed a media campaign to alert people to the famine, and that would help push the American government to act. "The North Koreans pulled a face," writes Nachos. "Their government would never agree to any media coverage, and we should forget about it. They were particularly insistent about not allowing any photographs of any kind, which is exactly what we most needed." "No photos," as Mr. Hyun would put it. Eventually, in the late 1990s, food aid from the United States, China, and Europe arrived in abundance. The regime took it, gave it to the army, the secret police, and the party cadres, and the hungry carried on dying. Nachos is scathing about the West's failure to act effectively when the evidence of famine was overwhelming. "The clash of these geostrategic interests with the humanitarian imperative to stop the famine caused the worst paralysis I have witnessed in any major relief effort since the close of the Cold War. Although food aid was pledged in the summer of 1997 and did arrive, it was 2 years too late, was sent to the wrong regions of the country, and had no rigorous controls on its internal distribution to prevent the elites from stealing it." Not everyone starved, of course. The phone call came in the middle of the night. For Ermanno Forlanis, Italian pizza chef, raconteur, and lover of life, it was the start of the most surreal adventure of his life. 2 weeks later, in the summer of 1997, Forlanis, his wife, another chef from the southern Italian city of Bari, Antonio Macchia, and his wife flew to Berlin. At Tegel Airport, the two couples were given tickets for a flight to Pyongyang that did not exist. Leastways, there was no mention of it on the departures board. The Air Korea jet was all but empty when it took off, destination North Korea. On arrival, the two chefs were hurried through the city to a brand new clinic entirely empty of patients. And then the tests started. Blood and urine samples were taken, x-rays, an electrocardiogram, and thanks to a large magnetic resonance imaging machine, a brain scan. "I was by now worried out of my mind," said Forlanis. "Here was proof that we were completely in their power, and they could do with us as they pleased." They had gone out of curiosity, forgetting what it had once done to the cat. The Italians waited for the results of the medical tests, and waited, and waited. Bored to distraction in their empty gilded cage, they were put in a luxury villa but deprived of contact with ordinary North Koreans. They begged their minder, Mr. Ohm, could they go to a club and dance. Mr. Ohm went away and came back. The answer was yes, but they didn't exactly end up in a nightclub. The Italians were taken to Kim Il-sung Square, where they found themselves in front of a sea of 30,000 people. After the master of ceremonies gave a signal, the crowd began to dance in uncannily precise formations. First, the mass formed 30 perfect squares, and as the music picked up tempo, the squares became stars, then circles. It was dancing for robots. They were witnessing the anniversary celebrations for the end of the Korean War. But Ermanno and his wife wanted to dance, not merely play the audience in yet another North Korean propaganda show. "Join them," said Mr. Ohm. Forlanis and his missus took to the floor and began whirling around with the North Koreans, who joked with them when they got their steps wrong. It meant a break from the boredom, but it wasn't what they had been hoping for. Suddenly, the test results came through, all clear, and they were on the road. The Italians were shocked by the poverty they glimpsed as their motorcade sped through the countryside. They saw people washing their clothes in the river and then waiting around naked for them to dry. It was like the Middle Ages, said Furlanis. The further they travelled, the more they realized that the country was strictly parcelled up, with frequent military checkpoints blocking people from travelling from one district to another. The couple witnessed scenes of mass desperation, with people screaming and begging the soldiers to let them through on either side of the checkpoints, with little or no chance of success. Travel was only allowed with a special permit issued by the Korean Workers' Party. As day turned into night, they drove on, coming across people appearing to sleep on the road itself. One man with a bicycle seemed to have nodded off on the tarmac, but with his legs either side of the bike frame, as though he was still riding it in his sleep. 1997 was the worst year of the famine, and it's possible that what the Italian couples were actually seeing was people so worn down by hunger they had collapsed on the road. Furlanis said, "We were scared a number of times. We thought we would end up running someone over." They ended up at a military base near the beach. To begin with, all the two chefs had to do was teach three North Korean chefs, who also seemed to be soldiers or at least behaved as if they were under military discipline, how to cook pizza. Ingredients were not a problem. Capers from Pantelleria, trout from San Daniele were amongst the delicacies that were rushed in from Italy, shipped along with several cases of Barolo from Piedmont. Furlanis said, "While I worked, my pupils, pen and notebook in hand, took down every detail while the rest of the staff, a dozen people or so, gathered round to watch the proceedings in an absorbed silence." Furlanis said that one of the students even asked to count the olives he used and to measure the distance between them. I don't know if he was just pulling my leg, but he looked totally serious. After several days of tuition, the chefs and their pizza ovens and other clobber were moved to a pontoon tied to a large yacht. The mysterious client remained invisible, not on the pontoon nor the yacht. Furlanis glimpsed through the yacht's windows something amazing, a man-made floating island which, he said, Fellini could not have imagined. The floating island boasted a magnificent villa three stories high, a large terrace out front, and gigantic fun slides that ended up in the water. Some soldiers later told him that the island also boasted its own racing track. No one ever discussed the kind of people who lived on that platform, but it could only have been Kim Jong-il. Suddenly, there was huge agitation on board. Crossing the gangplank to the ship was King Jong-il himself. Furlanis missed him, but he said, "Our chef, who had no reason to fib, was, for the space of several minutes, utterly speechless. He said he felt as if he had seen God, and I still envy him this experience." Furlanis raised the contrast between the leader's obscene levels of luxury and the plight of the people. Mr. Ohm replied, "Hermano, my good friend, man is the same all over the world." Only once did the Italians witness something resembling a protest against the regime. Every day, early in the morning, a crowd of cleaners would enter the compound gates as Furlanis's limousine drove past them, bound for where the yacht was docked. One morning, the gates opened to let the car in, but an elderly woman stood in front of it, placing her fists on the front of the car, shouting something. Furlanis asked for a translation, but Mr. Ohm ignored him. It was as if the scene did not exist. After a moment of hesitation, the driver weaved out of her way and accelerated off. Trivial interactions with the locals were not welcome. Mary Lou, Furlanis's wife, once walked past an open door on the first floor of their residential complex where some young North Koreans were playing video games and eating sweets. In broken English, they invited her to join them, seemingly enjoying the company of the exotic guest. Glad to have finally made some friends away from the tight supervision of Mr. Ohm, Mary Lou left them after 15 minutes to go back to her apartment. At around 1 o'clock in the morning, there was a knock on the door. Guards announced, "We are leaving now. Pack your bags." The Italian couple had no choice but to obey. They were taken to a second villa by the beach, even more secluded than the first. They had the entire first floor, while the ground floor was reserved for Mr. Ohm. While the men worked, the women had next to nothing to do. One day they were invited on a trip. Not realizing where they were going, they took no bathing costumes. When they ended up on a private beach very close to the villa, they stripped down to their underwear, not topless, entirely correct, but not acceptable for ultra-conservative North Korea. On the second day, they were taken to a small room where they were encouraged to borrow swimsuits straight out of the fashion pages of 1953. On the beach, the wives were monitored, their environment totally controlled. The sand was raked to the point of obsession, leaving it as hard as cement. Access to the sea was permitted, but only via a small pier covered in green velvet. Walking down the beach was not allowed. At the end of their narrow strip was an anti-aircraft gun position, made up of heavy machine guns and rockets. Mary Lou once put her feet in the shallows, an area not officially designated for bathing, which resulted in two young soldiers popping up, rifles at the ready, screaming their heads off. It wasn't exactly Capri. Furlanis and Macchia and their wives were rewarded for their hard work with very generous tips and the occasional trip to North Korean holiday sites. They were once taken to a supposedly uninhabited island, where expensive food and bottles of Barolo and Remy Martin were laid out for the Italian guests to enjoy. When their guide fell asleep after one too many glasses of wine, Furlanis set out to explore the island. After walking for a few minutes, he saw two men with bare chests and military fatigues fishing in the distance. He waved at them. They ran into the undergrowth. Puzzled, Furlanis decided to follow the two men, and as he walked further towards the center of the island, he saw two goats and a small kitchen garden with a few onions and tomatoes. As the other Italian guests joined him, they were soon encircled by other North Koreans. The mood turned sour. The Italians were scared. Two armed guards they knew arrived and ordered the Furlanises and the Macchias to return to the yacht they had arrived in. A football came out of nowhere. Being tipsy, the Italians told the guards to forget about Mr. Ohm and to join them in a game of football. The global magic of football did its trick. The North Koreans scored 3 early goals, but the Italians ended up winning 4-3, avenging the notorious 1-0 loss of the Azzurri in the 1966 World Cup at Middlesbrough. No one ever explained what the young men were doing on the supposedly deserted island. After 3 weeks, and with very little notice, the North Korean adventure was at an end. A Pakistani chef had already arrived, renowned for cooking the best chicken curry in the world. Their passports magically reappeared, and the Italian party prepared to be driven back to Pyongyang. As they left the military base, their students ran after the car for as long as they could, waving goodbye and lobbing them sweets through the windows. Once back at home in Italy, Furlanis hit the scales. In the middle of famine, he had managed to put on several kilos. Back in Wonsan, we caught a train to nowhere. An old-fashioned waiting room complete with cruelly thin wooden benches led us to a splendid black steam engine with great black wheels and a carriage or two painted blue with red stripes. Dylan sat by a carriage window and did a brilliant impression of Celia Johnson in Brief Encounter, waving to a disconsolate Trevor Howard, a hilarious moment unwittingly captured by the KITC cameraman. The train was the magical vehicle that took Kim Il-sung from the port of Wonsan to Pyongyang on the 20th of September 1945. Again, the date was not given in Juche time because the propagandization of the magical train journey took place long before 1997. Back in 1945, of course, Kim Il-sung was only a contender for power. That autumn, he rose to become top cherry for the Soviets, but he certainly didn't arrive at Wonsan as the chosen one. I left the museum and popped out into the fresh air, looking for the railway station proper. It wasn't there. They had created a mock railway station, simply for the purpose of falsifying history on wheels. Next, off to the Wonsan Children's Camp. There were no children. Well, no flesh-and-blood children, anyway. There was a bronze statue of Kim Il-sung in a western suit with his arms around a little boy with a trumpet in his hand and a slightly taller girl. Half hidden by a pine tree, but clearly visible on the KITC video, is a security camera watching over the statue from behind. To the left and right were two more CCTV cameras, which we filmed. None of us had ever seen a security camera in North Korea, and it could only have been placed there for one reason, fear of vandalism. It's possible that at least some of the international students from places like Russia, Vietnam, Burma, and Africa who have ended up in this camp dared show disrespect to authority. Even more shocking, it could be North Korean kids. We asked Mr. Hyun, why the CCTV? He asked the local guide. He translated that the CCTV was there to prevent a ploy by the South Korean secret agents to blow up the statue. It was perhaps the most preposterous explanation he gave in our whole trip. The statue was the centerpiece of a bleak square surrounded by Sovietische accommodation blocks. Further off was a fun fair and a water slide. The local guide explained that the rooms the students used were closed, so we couldn't see them, but we could look at the children's center. The whole place had a hangdog air of neglect about it. It looked as though it had been knocked up in the 1980s, possibly for the student games. The external walls were streaked with damp. A series of flagpoles stood barren, no flags flying. Inside, the lights being off, the facilities looked even bleaker in the gloom. A large vestibule was dedicated to photographs of the Kims, older black-and-white shots of Kim the First, then in colour, bad Elvis, being weird here, there and everywhere. Hey, look, kids, here's a picture of Dr. Evil opening a factory, just what a 12-year-old wants on holiday. Further on, there were snaps of Kim III in the rocket control room, urging his technicians on to Armageddon. I can't imagine any youngster looking at these photographs and being able to sleep at night. The comedy of the inappropriateness of the regime's propaganda drivel as something young teenagers might enjoy got to the group, and we started giggling. Our trepidation of the first day was long gone. Had we been invited to bow in front of the statue of Kim Il-sung and kids, CCTV and all, I doubt whether a single one of us would have done so. We walked past a large mosaic map of the world, with North Korea picked out in red, and we entered a great empty theatre, a forum for plays illustrating the excellence of Juche-ist internationalist thought, no doubt. Now that Kim Jong-un has been threatening thermonuclear war, it seems hard to imagine how the children's camp is going to compete with other attractions. On the way out, there was a plaster goose pulling down the trousers of a plaster pig. Disneyland can rest easy. Chapter 17. The American Who Went to North Korea and Stayed. On the 15th of August, 1962, Private James Joseph Dresnok of the U.S. Army walked across the DMZ and defected to North Korea. More than half a century later, he's still there, the father of three children. In the case against the North Korean regime, Dresnok is a disturbing witness for the defense, an American who quotes Kim Il-sung, condemns his old country for its military occupation of the South, and weeps at how his food ration remained good throughout the arduous march. He mouths the rhetoric of Pyongyang in a Virginian accent. A giant haystack of a man, 6'5", Dresnok was 72 years old at the time of writing in 2013. His bulk and metal fillings remind one of Jaws. In a documentary about his life, Dresnok drawls in his southern, quaintly old-fashioned speech, because his American has been uncorrupted for 50 years, by proclaiming, "I will give you the truth. I've never told anyone before." The last sentence may be true. Dresnok's story is told in Crossing the Line, made by two Britons, Nicholas Bonner, the impresario behind Korea Tours, one of the very few travel companies licensed to do business in North Korea, and Daniel Gordon, formerly of Sky TV. Bonner and Gordon are the leading Western lights in Pyongyewood, the North Korean movie industry. Their first film, The Game of Their Lives, 2001, tells the story of the North Korean football team which beat Italy in the 1966 World Cup. A State of Mind, 2005, is a subtle and beautifully observed film about two young girls training to take part in the Pyongyang Mass Games. Crossing the Line, 2007, is the most political of their films. All of their work is fascinating because they get extraordinarily good access to North Korea. But that very access raises questions about how far you go in a trade-off with a totalitarian state. Bonner, as boss of Korea Tours, believes in working with the North Korean regime. Observer travel writer Carol Cadwallader was allowed to go to North Korea. She wrote, "I have a special rare dispensation as a travel writer because Nick Bonner, the founder of Korea Tours, believes that the more the world engages with North Korea, the more North Korea will engage with the world. And because I've agreed in advance that I shan't write about North Korea's human rights record or in any way insult the dear leader." None of Bonner's films do. Bonner has been asked whether he has been at best willfully naive in promoting North Korea as anything less than a bizarre and oppressive tyranny. He replied, "We believe very strongly in engagement. Since 1945, the West has worked on very few policies to engage with North Korea on a cultural level. If being naive represents lack of experience, well, we have more experience than most, and as for lack of wisdom or being duped, I think the projects we have worked on with our Korean colleagues are testament to the effectiveness of engagement and understanding." Dresnok's story officially runs like this. He was born into a poor family in Virginia in 1941. His father abandoned the family before he was 10. After a broken upbringing, in and out of foster homes, he enlisted in the U.S. Army when he was 17. His first marriage broke up after he returned from a 2-year tour in Germany. "I'm just thankful we never had any kids, because I swore I would never leave my children," he says in the film, tears pouring down his face. Dresnok re-enlisted and went to South Korea. He found discipline unbearable, was caught with prostitutes, and faced court-martial. One summer's day in 1962, while cleaning his army shotgun, he upped sticks and walked across the Z. "I was fed up with my childhood, my marriage, my military life, everything. I was finished. There's only one place to go." On August 15th at noon in broad daylight when everybody was eating lunch, I hit the road. Yes, I was afraid. Am I going to live or die? And when I stepped into the minefield, and I seen it with my own eyes, I started sweating. I crossed over, looking for my new life. The Korean People's Army took him prisoner, but treated him correctly, the story goes. Soon he was introduced to another American deserter. I opened my eyes, I didn't believe myself. I shut them again, I must be dreaming. I opened them again and looked, and who in the hell are you? His name was Larry Abshire, another GI defector who had crossed the line 3 months before Dresnok. Two more U.S. Army defectors would join them in the next 2 years, Jerry Parrish and Sergeant Charles Robert Jenkins. All four were running away from internal torment. They had no idea what they were getting into. Dresnok recalled what it was like being an American in North Korea a decade after the Civil War. The uneasiness of the way people look at me when I walk down the street. Oh, there goes that American bastard. In 1966, the four Americans sought asylum in the Soviet embassy in Pyongyang. The Russians said sorry but handed them straight back. Dresnok set his mind to making a go of his new life. Or so he says. They might be a different race, they might be a different color, but God damn it, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to learn their way of life. I did everything I could, learning the language, learning the customs, learning their greetings, their life. Oh, I got to think like this, I got to act like this. I've studied their revolutionary history, their lofty virtues about the great leader. His devotion was rewarded in 1978 with a starring role in one episode of a North Korean TV series, Unknown Heroes. Dresnok plays Lieutenant Colonel Arthur, a psychotic American commander of a POW camp in shades, Zapata mustache, and matching handgun. Unknown Heroes makes a bad spaghetti western look like The Searchers. It is the Yankee soldiers took out their bayonets and sliced through the women's breasts like bean curd on acid, on tape. Dresnok told Bonner and Gordon, I don't consider it a propaganda movie. I took great honor in doing it. Orwell's clock just struck 13. One is compelled to wonder whether Dresnok's lost his marbles or whether he is a captive who has to say what his jailers want him to say. Having been inside North Korea for more than 50 years, that may come fluently, but one should not mistake fluency for truth. Crossing the line does not cross the line by asking simple questions of the regime. Gordon has said, we have taken an apolitical viewpoint. The assumption that you can be apolitical in a totalitarian dictatorship like North Korea is a big fat one. Over pictures of soldiers running into battle, American bombers dropping their payloads on the North, flaming houses and refugees running from the inferno, the commentary voiced by Christian Slater of Vampire Chronicles fame intones, in 1950, Korea experienced at first hand the brutal realities of the Cold War, a clash of ideologies that would devastate the peninsula. The Korean War was one of the most vicious of the century. Nowhere does crossing the line make clear that this war was started by the North. Is that apolitical? Or mucking about with history? As well as being a Pyongyewood star, Dresnok helped translate the great leader's wisdom into vernacular English and taught English at the spy school, Pyongyang University of Foreign Languages. In the film, he tells how he met a beautiful brunette. I thought I was the happiest man in the world. I went completely crazy. But her name, identity, and origin remain a mystery for the viewer. Dresnok says, I'd get her drunk and ask her, and she'd say, shut up, don't ask that question. The mystery European woman and Dresnok had two sons, Ted Ricardo Dresnok and James Gabriel Dresnok. His wife died, and he married the daughter of an African diplomat and a Korean woman. She and Dresnok have a boy, now 11 years old. Dresnok's second son, James Gabriel, is a real catch for Pyongywood, a handsome, blue-eyed, strapping young man who looks 100% American but speaks English with a halting, heavily Korean accent. He doesn't just speak like a North Korean, he acts like one, too. If you were to do a 21st-century remake of The Manchurian Candidate, James Gabriel would be the star. Funnily enough, he, too, is studying at the elite foreign language university. My father is American, and I've got American blood. But as I was born here, I consider myself a Korean, James Gabriel told Bonner and Gordon. James Gabriel is a living fossil from the Cold War, a human coelacanth. Crossing the Line's director, Gordon, told CBS, his best friend, who's Korean, says, all the Korean girls love him. They love him. He's got blonde hair and blue eyes. In the film, James Gabriel says, I start to learn English to become a diplomat. I'd like to make the world which has no war at all, and no terror at all. James Gabriel seems unaware of the Kim dynasty's track record on terrorism. The bomb on Korean Air Flight 858, killing 115 people in 1987. The training camp for the IRA men. The kidnapping of foreign nationals. On that very issue, he could have asked his mother. Was she Doina Bumba, the Romanian artist who vanished in 1978? That question haunted her family back in Romania when they heard about the film and got to watch it, and with mounting horror realized that James Gabriel looked astonishingly like their daughter, missing for almost 3 decades. Had Doina ended up in North Korea? Doina's tragedy is as black as can be. On Facebook, there is a page dedicated to her memory. The photographs are heartbreaking, showing a young woman of real beauty, dark-haired, elfin. Born in 1950, the daughter of a Romanian officer and a Russian woman, she became an artist. One photograph shows her cuddling her much younger brother, what looks like a self-portrait in the background. A second, the cocky artist on the make, sporting a black hat, leopard skin coat and jeans, standing by one of her paintings. She had real talent, her work reminiscent of Modigliani. A third, Doina in a floral patterned dress, eyeing the camera, self-confident, poised, happy to take on the world. She married an Italian, moved to Rome, fell pregnant, had a miscarriage, and got divorced. Looking for fresh adventure, and who doesn't at the age of 28, she was approached by an Italian man who offered her exciting prospects of working in the art scene in the Far East. She jumped at the chance. Her family last had contact with Doina when she called from Italy to say she was travelling to Tokyo and promised to call immediately after she arrived. That was in 1978. The family never heard from her again. Doina's promise, her future, was robbed from her. Instead, she entered a world of worry. None of Doina's story is clear or easy to tell. Instead, there are scraps of dog-eared information here and there which float down over the decades. After her trip to the Far East, no one hears of her for nigh on 30 years. We know what happened next, thanks to another kidnapping, on the far side of the world. In 1978, the same year that Doina vanished, Hitomi Soga lived on a small island off the west coast of Japan. One August evening, she went for a walk at dusk with her mother, enjoyed an ice cream, and was only a few hundred yards from home when her life changed forever. 3 men grabbed her from behind, tied her hands, stuffed a gag in her mouth, bundled her into a big black plastic bag, and carried her to a skiff. The skiff went out to sea. Then she was dumped in the hold of a ship. She never saw her mother again. It is most likely that she resisted, and her kidnappers murdered her. The ship sailed for a whole day until it arrived at the port of Chungjin. The next morning they told Hitomi, "Maybe it would be fun for you to go to the beach and look for some clams." Evidence to the man who became her husband of how strange the North Korean cadres are, how out of touch they are with the emotions normal people have. Hitomi was bereft, afraid, sick to the bottom of the heart. And then one day she was introduced to a small, wiry American who became the great love of her life. Charles Robert Jenkins, one of the four soldier defectors like Dresnok. Dreading the thought of being sent to Vietnam, unhappy and insecure, Jenkins ran across the DMZ in 1965, a decision he was to regret. He owes his liberty to the regime's obsession with racial purity, the feckless incompetence of Kim Jong-il, and the power of Hitomi's love for him. The kidnapping of foreigners began in 1977 as Kim II's sway in the regime grew. But Kim Il-sung had survived in Manchuria in the late 1930s by kidnapping the family members of rich farmers demanding ransoms. Kidnapping was old Kim family business. 13 of the known kidnap victims were Japanese, plucked from ordinary lives, walking home at night, going for a stroll on the beach, then suddenly pinioned by strangers, forced into a small boat and down the hatch of a North Korean submarine or fishing boat, only to reappear in Pyongyang to start a new life in absolute terror. Some were from Lebanon, Thailand, ordinary people engulfed by a power acting with no accountability. Why kidnap foreigners? The most likely explanation is the regime's obsession with espionage. Professor Yoichi Shimada of Fukui University in Japan told a U.S. Congress Human Rights Subcommittee in 2006, "North Korean defectors have told us that in 1976, Kim Jong-il issued a secret order to use foreign nationals more systematically and thereby improve the quality of North Korean spy activities. He dubbed it localization of spy education." The professor suggested 6 reasons for the kidnapping. North Korea appears to abduct foreign citizens in order to eliminate hapless witnesses who happened to run into North Korean agents in action, steal victims' identities, force abductees to teach their local language and customs to North Korean agents, brainwash them into secret agents, use abductees' expertise, use abductees as spouses for defectors or other abductees. Thanks to its belief in racial purity, the foreigners could not marry North Koreans. But if the defectors and the kidnapped women could have children together, then their progeny might be useful as agents. This, sick as it is, might also be part of the regime's logic. In 2002, in a thaw in relations between the old colonial power Japan and North Korea, the Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi visited Pyongyang. On offer was a big deal: billions of aid money from Japan in return for North Korea burying the hatchet. One irritant for the Japanese were the persistent rumors that a score of their people had been kidnapped. To smooth things along, Kim Jong-il blithely admitted the regime had abducted 13 Japanese citizens in the 1970s and 80s and released the names of a handful of Japanese who were still alive, including Hitomi. The irony is that she was not on any Japanese list of abductees. Her disappearance and that of her mother had been all but forgotten. It took the Japanese media less than 24 hours to stand up the story. She and her mother vanished in 1978, and the immensely hostile reaction from the Japanese public to the kidnaps smashed the proposed deal to pieces. Kim Jong-il, with no sense of what public opinion can do, was at sea. Soon the Japanese abductees were on their way home. He told me never gave up on her man, and eventually, after pressure from the Japanese, Jenkins was allowed to leave too, escaping after 40 years from what he describes as a giant demented prison. He tells his story in The Reluctant Communist. Read it. Jenkins paints a bleak and wholly convincing picture of 4 decades inside the DPRK. He describes the freezing cold, the hunger that lasted for year after year, the petty corruption of the cadres detailed to look after them, the boredom, the emotional anguish of realizing his treachery against the United States was an unrecoverable mistake, the brainwashing, the gibberish and horseshit of Juche-ism, the time they found a cat's cradle of microphones in the loft of one of their houses, listening in to their every word. Initially, the 4 Americans shared a house. Nearby, there were some houses which they had been told were off-limits. In the same area, they had seen the army digging a hole in the ground. A while later, the hole had been filled in, leaving just a bald spot of earth. A dog was digging up the fresh dirt. That's when we saw them, 2 dead human feet sticking right up out of the ground. We didn't believe what we were seeing, but we took a closer look, and sure enough, there was no mistaking it. From the size of the grave, about 2 by 5 yards, it could have held 5 to 10 people. A few days later, however, we saw a woman running down a hill from where the grave was. She was screaming her head off, and we knew exactly what it was all about. A little while later, people from the army came around and killed every dog in the neighborhood. Jenkins says Dresnok became a stooge, a loyal and faithful servant of what Jenkins calls in his book the organization, that is, the regime, the party, the secret police, whatever. Jenkins says Dresnok tortured him on the orders of their minders, habitually beating him to a pulp. Dresnok, in Crossing the Line, calls Jenkins a liar and says of his fellow American, "Bye-bye, baby, who cares?" CBS asked Gordon, was there any sense of the government ordering Dresnok to beat Jenkins? The Pyongyang director replied, "We never got that sense from Dresnok. He just denied and denied and denied that he was the North Korean strong arm." From what we can gather, there was a lot of times when it was drink-oriented. They went out and they drank and they drank and they had a fight. Dresnok says in the film, "One day he tried to push me around with his so-called rank, and there was 2 blows. Jenkins had been a sergeant, Dresnok a private. I hit him and he hit the ground. I think you know Alice in Wonderland. Well, I just wonder if it's not Jenkins in a Wonderland." Crossing the Line does reflect Jenkins's version of events, but the star of the film is Dresnok, not Jenkins. Nick Bonner, at a Q&A after a screening of the film in Beijing, faces the question, which of the 2 men does he believe? He answers it by imitating Dresnok's southern drawl, mocking Jenkins's claims that he was tied up then beaten. "Tie him up? Why would I need to tie him up? I could hold him in one hand and beat him with the other." The audience laughs. Perhaps they haven't been to North Korea. The detail of Jenkins's account in his book of Dresnok beating him up is compelling. For example, Jenkins specifically recalls the date on which Dresnok's attacks on him began, 9 September 1972, the anniversary of the foundation of the Workers' Party. Jenkins angers his minder, whom he calls the tall cadre. The Americans are held under loose house arrest because they know that they stand out a mile in racially pure North Korea. The tall cadre ties Jenkins up and orders Dresnok to hit him. Jenkins is small and compact, Dresnok a much bigger man. The sick bastard enjoyed it. He took solid, square-knuckled cracks at me across my face, one after another. My nose began to gush blood after the first few swings. By the time he had finished, my top lip had split in two places, and my bottom teeth were sticking out of the skin between my lower and my chin. Why was he always an eager torturer? He had become a stooge. So who to believe? If Jenkins is a liar, as Dresnok insists, then his information about Doina cannot be relied upon. The fine detail of Dresnok's military record does not feature in Crossing the Line. His old local paper, The Virginian, dug it up. On the 26th of January 1960, Dresnok stole a Volkswagen valued at $715 from its owner, Franz Schumann, and threatened a second German with a bayonet. He was court-martialed but got a suspended sentence. In South Korea, he made a poor impression. One report described him as a chronic complainer, lazy and defiant to authority. In July of 1962, he faced a second court-martial over a forged pass, drinking, indebtedness, and promiscuity. A few days before the hearing, he crossed the Z. None of the above makes Dresnok out to be a bad, bad man, but it is evidence of a weakness of character the organization could play on. In the film, Dresnok does not come across well. One newspaper reviewer in the States found Dresnok unconvincing. Although a curious study in political exploitation for most of the film, snippets of the Kim Jong-il-directed propaganda epic Nameless Heroes, starring Dresnok as a sinister American, are fascinating. By the end, his sallow, corpulent frame has settled into stooge-like, Kool-Aid-drunk offensiveness. What about Jenkins, the man? His ghost writer, Time journalist Jim Frederick, says, "Robert Jenkins tells the truth. There have been numerous times when Robert told me something that either sounded insane, trumped up, or nonsensical, only to have my doubts shattered by the realization that he was absolutely correct." Although Dresnok recently denied to a documentary film crew in North Korea, Bonner and Gordon, that he ever beat up Robert in anything more than a single fair fistfight, it seems to me to be such an odd thing to fabricate, and a thing that reflects poorly on Robert. Frederick asks, "What soldier would want to admit that he couldn't defend himself against another? I can't imagine why he would make a story like that up." To this day, the regime does not admit that it abducted anyone else apart from the 13 Japanese they have already confessed to kidnapping. But there are seriously evidenced reports that South Korean, Thai, and Lebanese women were also kidnapped, and perhaps too, one Romanian. Jenkins, in his book, touches on an Eastern European woman who ended up marrying Dresnok. He calls her Doina. Her story, says Jenkins, was that she met this Italian big-shot art dealer who was, in retrospect, a North Korean sympathizer or paid agent. He invited her to Hong Kong. She didn't have an Italian or Romanian passport at the time, but the Italian supplied her with North Korean papers. On the way to Hong Kong, they stopped over in Pyongyang. There she faced hostile interrogation that her papers were fake. The trap was sprung. There was no way out. Is the woman Jenkins calls Doina the Romanian artist Doina, who disappeared in 1978? Ceausescu's former interpreter Isidore Urian is haunted by Doina's story. He sounded wretched when he explained that he went through all of the old Romanian archives trying to find any mention of her case. There was nothing there. But if Doina's kidnap was a black operation by the North Koreans, the absence of evidence in the Bucharest archives does not mean much. Jenkins gets one detail wrong, saying that the Italian who kidnapped her promised her work in the art scene in Hong Kong, not Tokyo, where she told her family she was going. But people often mistake small details of a story like that. There are two more facts the old sergeant does remember. The first is that Jenkins says of Donna, "She was one hell of an artist. She could draw like she knew what she was doing." Donna's second boy, James Gabriel, the blue-eyed star of Crossing the Line, was known as Gabby to Jenkins. Doina's younger brother, the one she is seen cuddling in the photograph when he was around 3, is called Gabriel. "It's the same woman, Gabriel Bumba told me. She is my sister. I am 100% convinced. Jenkins and Hitomi lived with my sister for 19 years. After the film was aired, Gabriel flew to Japan in 2007 and met Jenkins and Hitomi. Jenkins gave Gabriel a much fuller picture of Doina than he set out in his book, written in 2004. Jenkins said that Doina told him about the mystery Italian, how they had stopped off in Moscow but ended up in Pyongyang. First, in 1978, she was sent to a paramilitary training camp, which sounds pretty much like one described by Len, the IRA man. There she was taught Kim Il-sungism, martial arts, and that in North Korea, to eat, you had to obey. No one in the outside world knew where she was. She had no hope of escape. No hope at all. The marriage with Dresnok was arranged by the organization. Jenkins recalls seeing Doina just after the birthday of Larry Abshire's son. She was beautiful and intelligent. In 1981, she still dreamed of escape back to Italy. At the birthday party, Doina asked Jenkins, "When will I be free?" Jenkins replied, "Never." Jenkins said that the marriage with Dresnok was not happy. There were endless rows, beatings too. Doina ran away from home at times, but in North Korea, where any Caucasian stands out a mile, she had no chance. The four couples lived in a compound not far from Pyongyang, Dresnok and Doina and their two boys, known as Ricardo and Gabby, Jenkins and Hitomi and their two daughters. Abshire and his wife, who Dresnok in Crossing the Line claims was a Korean, but Jenkins says is a Thai, Anocha Panjoy, also kidnapped, and Jerry Parrish and his wife Siham Shrieta, originally from the Lebanon, and their three sons. Siham says in Crossing the Line that she is happy to stay in North Korea. The film does not point out the strong likelihood that her three boys are effective hostages and that Siham may have been rehearsing her jailer's script. As she talks, her face looks unbearably strained. They did not make for happy families. Jenkins says that was because of Dresnok. Jenkins says that as well as being violent towards him and Doina, Dresnok beat up Abshire, a simple, sweet, good-hearted soul who was more than a little dumb and easy to take advantage of. At one point, on Jenkins's illicit radio, they heard a dramatization of Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, after which Dresnok and Parrish would mock Abshire as Lenny, the dumb giant. Abshire died of a heart attack in 1983. On his tombstone, it was written his place of birth was Pyongyang. That should have been Urbana, Illinois. Doina sold a gold necklace she'd managed to keep from Italy for a sewing machine. An excellent seamstress, she made clothes for all of the children, and she was a good cook too, magicking fine-ish meals out of miserable ingredients. Her specialty was a Russian salad, and when they had meat, she knew how to grill it to perfection. She even cultivated a piece of land, growing corn, potatoes, and onions. Their two sons grew up. Ricardo, the oldest, was more rebellious. Aged 20, he sneaked out to a party thrown by children of some diplomats in Pyongyang. For this crime, he was sentenced to 6 months in prison. He pops up in Crossing the Line, but is not interviewed. Unlike his younger brother, James Gabriel, the student at the spy school, although the film does not call it that. It's possible that the older brother is less compliant, less brainwashed. Doina died of cancer in 1997, Hitomi giving her shots of morphine to ease the pain. Back in Romania, her family continued to know nothing of her fate for another decade. Jenkins said, "Doina told both of her boys that she is Romanian and she was kidnapped." All of this makes Dresnok's statement in Crossing the Line that he did not know where the mother of his two boys was from, shut up, don't ask that question, incredible. Gabriel Bumba told me, "I dream of my nephews getting out of North Korea and coming home to Romania. My mother Petra, who is now 84, only lives for the day when she can see her grandsons. The two boys are all that's left of my sister, and we want to meet them." To lose the blue-eyed, blonde-haired James Gabriel Dresnok would, of course, be a disaster for Pyongyewood. It's only because of Crossing the Line that Doina's Romanian family know what happened to her, and for that they are grateful to Bonner and Gordon. But that happy consequence appears to have been unintended. A film setting out North Korea's version of the Americans who crossed the DMZ ends up revealing by mistake a hitherto unknown and monstrous case of kidnapping. Pyongyewood's dream factory screwed up big time. Crossing the Line's emotional crescendo comes when Dresnok weeps at the thought that the regime made sure he was supplied with enough food at the height of the arduous march, the regime's newspeak for the famine, while so many perished. Dresnok is moved to tears by the graciousness of the dear leader. Thinking about the tragedy of the four Americans who made the long mistake of defecting to North Korea and the crueler fate of the kidnap victims they ended up being married to, one could imagine a different ending. Rather than giving the stage to the regime stooge, better, surely, to use a line from Jim Frederick, Jenkins's ghostwriter, that they were all consumed by an almost unbearably understated evil. And if Doina's two boys remain in North Korea, an evil that continues to this day. Chapter 18. The Hospital That Has Patients, But Only in the Morning. In the half-light of the morning, Wonsan was revealed to us. The sea was calm, the sun shone, but it's not exactly Saint-Tropez. The North Korean Riviera has some way to